African flavors and food traditions have had a big influence on American cooking. But our next guest says those contributions haven't always been widely understood or recognized. Her award-winning book, High on the Hog, was recently adapted as a Netflix series. It traces the global history of Africa's impact on American food from before the transatlantic slave trade through today. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you watched and or read High on the Hog? Where do you see Africa's impact on American food? What questions do you have about the history of these food traditions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jessica B. Harris is a leading culinary historian and expert on foodways of the African diaspora and the winner of a James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award. And she'll be talking at UW-Stevens Point in Wausau today at 6 and at UW-Stevens Point main campus tomorrow at 6. Both events free with pre-registration. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What got you started down this path of tracing this incredible history of African and African-American cooking?
In a word, my mouth. But it's a little more complicated than that. It goes back probably to the 1970s at that point in time. I was the travel editor for Essence magazine. And then from Essence began to make connections, the different places that I visited, tasted things. It's like, oh, that tasted like something I had last week or 2 months ago or last year. And then I started drawing lines, not only mentally, but then research lines and looking at A, B, and seeing if they connected and maybe how they went on to connect with C. And the rest, as they say, is, if not history, at least the story of my life.
And as you started doing this, you kept finding more and more gaps in the actual history, and I think our current understanding of that history when it comes to Black Americans' contributions to the food we eat today. What were the gaps you were hoping to fill in this project?
Oh, goodness. It wasn't so much as gaps as it was probably what I would call silences. Mm-hmm. I think the thing is that in many cases, things were not so much eliminated as simply glossed over. I once gave a lecture called Studying the Silences that talks about how one of the things that I learned to do was how to reread my readings of history, how to look at things sort of obliquely, how to look at the things that weren't said as much as the things that were said, and maybe through those things that were eliminated, glossed over, or just, you know, casually not mentioned, begin to make and draw and look for my history.
And a big part of the premise for your book, and I agree with it, is that we can learn a lot about ourselves and our cultures through the food we eat, how we make it, who we eat it with. Can you talk about the value of this close examination of food in particular?
Well, I mean, we're humans, and the bottom line about food for humans, at least, is if we don't eat, we die. And so it is enormously important. We have to eat. And because we have some degree of choice about what we eat, we then form our cultures around what we eat, or what we eat expresses our cultures, which is probably a better way to say it. So that old adage, you are what you eat, is never more important. We are exactly what we eat, whether we are what we eat by what is actually on the plate, or we are what we eat by what is no longer on the plate, or what is refused on the plate. All of those things contribute to the who and the why of us.
A lot of the foods you trace, some of them we might associate today with Black American food or African American food. A lot of them, I think, we see as American food without realizing some of the connections. Can you talk about daily staples in the United States like macaroni and cheese and others that have this silence in the history?
Well, I mean, I think people are fascinated by mac and cheese. I know one of the things that I have in my house that is something that people just go gaga over is many, many years ago, I did some consulting work for Kraft Foods. And as a thank you, they put my picture on a mac and cheese box. It was never sold in stores, but I have one copy and it's framed and in my kitchen. And people just go, oh, my goodness, you're on the mac and cheese box. I think the thing is that it really has a resonance for us. it, you know, it means holidays, it means home, it means whatever the varying and various things are that it means to us, whether we are black or white or chartreuse. But I think the thing that's often forgotten is it is a dish that was popularized by an African-American chef. His name was James Hemings. He was the enslaved chef of Thomas Jefferson. He was an extraordinarily talented person. He was so talented that when Jefferson was in Paris as the ambassadeur plénipotentiaire to the court of Louis XVI, the late Louis XVI, I might add, he sent for Hemings to join him in Paris. Hemings did. There's a whole long story about that, which we don't have time for. But the thing is that as a result, when Hemings is leaving France, and he does leave France to return to the United States, when he does that, he is bringing some recipes with him. And among those recipes is an essentially Italian dish that he has learned in Europe, which comes to the States and becomes our mac and cheese.
Jessica B. Harris is with us, author of the book High on the Hog, which was made into a Netflix series. Jessica, speaking in Wisconsin today and tomorrow, 6 p.m. today at UW Stevens Point in Wausau, tomorrow at 6 at the UW Stevens Point main campus. You can join in if you have a question for Jessica about the history we're talking about at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jessica, speaking of things we don't have time to do, you've eaten so many foods in so many places in Africa. What were some of the foods that you ate there that, as you mentioned, really struck a chord with you as similar to things you might have eaten here in the States?
Well, I think the main thing, well, the one that was my, as Oprah would put it, aha moment, was in 1972. I was in Senegal doing research for my doctorate. And I was actually with my mother, and I had a dish called poulet yassa, or yassa ganar, and it was chicken yassa. Now, it wasn't a familiar dish, but it combined a variety of tastes that were familiar, that were sort of home tastes to me. It was chicken that had been grilled and then stewed. First marinated, then grilled, then stewed. So you get flavor infused in it three different ways. The chicken is marinated with onion and lemon juice, so you get that sort of citrusy thing. I happen to adore onions. The great apocryphal Jessica tale is that I used to sit on my mother's kitchen floor as a young child and eat them like apples. But so onions, lemons, chicken, it tasted unfamiliar and yet familiar. So that was the thing that sort of set off my light bulb. The other Senegalese dish, which does have descendants, if you will, in this country, would have been the national dish of Senegal, which is cheboujen. Cheb means rice. So this is a rice that is made red with tomato paste or tomato sauce and then served with vegetables and fish. Now, the dish as it wasn't something I was familiar with. But certainly the rice is something I was familiar with. The tomato paste. The tomato paste flavoring the rice was equally something I was familiar with. And that dish goes on to become what some of us know as jollof rice. Jollof because of the Wolof Empire the Jollof Empire of the Wolof people. It goes down into Ghana and Nigeria, and they fight about it, whose dish it really is. And then it comes across the Atlantic, and here we find its descendants in things like Louisiana's jambalaya and Charleston's red rice.
Now, both your book and the Netflix series take a close look at the intersection of food and slavery, the slave trade and the realities of slavery here in the United States. Can you share a little bit of that intersection with us?
I'm not really sure. The bottom line is, for more than 200, possibly longer years in this country, what would become the United States, African Americans have been at the bedrock of the agriculture and much of the culinary. Certainly in the southern parts of the United States, the agriculture, north, central, and south, it's kind of hard to grow the food, process the food, prepare the food, cook the food, and serve the food without having some degree of influence. So I'd say our influence is pretty strong.
We're talking to Jessica B. Harris, expert on foodways of the African diaspora, author of a lot of books, including High on the Hog, recently adapted as a Netflix series, speaking today in Wausau, tomorrow in Stevens Point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of African food, African-American food here in the United States, the influence it's had? Are we talking about your family's own food traditions? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with culinary historian Jessica B. Harris. I have two talks she's giving, one in Wausau today at 6, another in Stevens Point tomorrow at 6. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time for event info. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the history of African influences, African-American influences on American food. There are a lot of them. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller with Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I went to Chicago when I was a kid and went to Union Station, and my grandpa got me to try grits, and we tried chitlins, and I'd never tried those things before. But as a kid, I thought they were pretty cool. But my question is about shortening bread. Is there such a thing called shortening bread or shortening bread?
Yes, there is. In fact, you know the song probably. Mammy's little baby loves shortening, shortening. Mommy's little baby loves shortening bread. Put on the skillet, put on the lead. Mama's going to make some shortening bread. It is cornbread in some cases, sort of skillet cornbread. And for other people, it's almost like a tea cake. So you got a whole lot of leeway in between. But the shortening bread, I believe, is the sort of skillet cornbread.
Jeff, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We got an email from Grant who says, it seems African peanut stews are well known, but how have peanuts been used in other African dishes?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting is that we kind of think of the peanut as being native to the African continent, and it's not. It is actually native to this hemisphere. It goes early to the African continent, where it supplants something that's called the Bambara groundnut, which is another sort of another plant that's similar to peanuts. What happens with that is it takes over some of those stews, some of those sauces, but they also turn up in marinades. They turn up just plainly on the street. I mean, one of my fondest memories of Senegal is they cook peanuts in heated sand, and the peanuts get really, really toasted and brown. They're called ngerte, and if you walk down any of the streets, you can buy a little cone of newspaper and have the ngerte, the peanuts, in them to eat.
Interesting. Thanks for emailing that question, Grant. Another silent part of the history I had no idea about, Jessica, catering, pretty common line of work in the United States today. Can you talk about some of the early African-American pioneers of what we now call the catering business?
Okay, I can, but I'm doing that tonight.
Uh-oh. At Wausau. Well, give us a sneak preview. You don't have to spill the whole thing.
Tiny sneak preview is they used to say in Philadelphia, if you weren't a caterer, you were kind of in the soup. But if you were a caterer, you were living high on the hog. And that's a bad paraphrasing of a quote that I will have the exact version of tonight.
Excellent. Now, I know you're looking at the history, of course, but you have hopes for what people take away from it for the modern day and the way we, I think of food. What are you hoping that people take from your book or the Netflix series and do with it in the future?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. I think the most valuable, if you will, thing about food is when we share food, we learn that we're more alike than we are different. I mean, we've talked about peanuts, we've talked about various rice dishes, so many cultures across the board, African American and other, share these foods, these ingredients. And I think that when we start to look at what's in each other's pots, if you will, we can say, maybe not that different from me.
Talking to Jessica B. Harris, culinary historian, author of the book High on the Hog. There is a Netflix series of the same name, looking at the history of African food, African-American food, this huge influence on the United States. Go to WPR.org/Central Time because she's talking tonight in Wausau, tomorrow in Stevens Point. Are there foods, Jessica, when you're here in the United States, you look back to your trips to Africa and you think, I wish I was eating this there with them right now?
Oh, yes, many, many, many meals. One notable one that sort of sprang immediately to mind when you started kind of in on that question is, multiple decades ago, let me just leave it at that, some friends, some newly made friends who have now been my friends for more than about 40 years, I met totally by accident. I was doing an interview and at the husband's office. He is an expansive man and said, you must come home for dinner. I later found out that his wife had told him, if you bring another person home for dinner, I'm going to divorce you. So rather than have a divorce, she said, so we're going out. And they picked a place. It was called Shembay Mbarik. It is on the outskirts of Dakar on a beach. It is a place that specializes in meshoui. Meshoui is a spit-roasted lamb. And so I got to know these people for the first time, sitting in sort of beach chairs with a table in between us, picking delicate, tender pieces of lamb off of the lamb that had been spit roasted and forming a friendship. And that was my idea of a pretty darn good meal.
That sounds really good. That idea of forming a friendship, I mean, there's something magical about having a meal with someone. That's almost like a dividing line between an acquaintance and a friend. Why is that?
Well, I think it's the commensality of food. It is the sharing spirit almost over food. It is the part about sharing a meal with someone that is almost the magic, that is the part that becomes spiritual. I have a hard time eating with people I don't like. You know, sometimes business lunches are a little difficult. I equally sometimes have a hard time with eating people I don't know. But I love to eat with people simply because I find that I learn so much about them through just sitting with them, through sharing with them. And that idea of sharing food among people, sharing food around a table, is important. I contend that, you know, a lot of peace treaties are signed around tables. A lot of stuff happens around tables, and I think there is something about the locus of table, whether or not it's a table in the European sense or a mat on the floor or any other variation of it. Gathering around it creates community, and that's the thing I like about sharing food.
Now, we've talked mostly about food today. You've written a lot about food, but you have studied and written about a lot of other things. I get the impression that you have just kind of, I don't know, an insatiable sense of curiosity. Why has curiosity been such an important value for you?
Because I'm a nosy broad, in a couple of words. I mean, I just want to know, you know. I just am curious about things. I have been fortunate to have had an extraordinary education, and it has allowed me to pursue some avenues. Why is this? How is this? What makes this happen? Who does that? Why y'all doing that over here and not over here? All of those questions are things that I want the answer to, and so I just keep poking my nose in until I get the answer or I get smacked on the nose.
Now, for people out there listening who've gotten hungry, like I have, listening to you talk about these foods, and maybe who aren't familiar with a lot of the different foods you're writing about, can you suggest some good starting points, things that they could cook and maybe get, you know, maybe not perfect, but in the right neighborhood, maybe a little advice to try some of the foods that are part of this history?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I think that there are just so many recipes. There's so many African-American cookbooks, needless to say my own, but there are other writers. I mean, Toni Tipton Martin has written a book called Jubilee. Carla Hall has several books out. I'm blanking on names now. There are also histories. Adrian Miller has a history of black barbecue called Black Smoke. Library, or as a rude friend of mine says, Google you, or, you know, do a little research, cursory research. It doesn't have to be a deep dive, but you'll find names. Go to the library. Librarians are your friend. Librarians are wonderful. They will help you. They will find recipes for you because recipes are so personal. Some people like the savory. Some people like the sweet. For me to recommend something would be, you know, crazy. I've talked about the chicken yassa. It was a good starting point for me. It might be for other people. I do a column, if I can advertise my own column.
You can.
For eatingwell.com called Diaspora Dining. I do another one for the Today Show, today.com, that is called My Culinary Compass. And for those who are still reading magazines like me, I do a third one for Southern Living that's about Southern food. They've all got recipes, too.
Jessica, thanks so much for joining us, and enjoy your time in Wisconsin.
Thank you so very much. I'm enjoying being here. I even brought a coat, so I'm good for the weather.
Excellent. That's Jessica B. Harris, culinary historian, leading authority on food traditions of the African diaspora, and author of a lot of books, including High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. It's recently turned into a Netflix series of the same name. You can hear more. She's talking at UW-Stevens Point's Wausau campus today at 6. Also at UW-Stevens Point's main campus tomorrow at 6. Both events are free with pre-registration. We've got a link to event info at WPR.org/Central Time. She mentioned the author, Toni Tipton Martin. Check out our archives. We talked to her about that book, Jubilee.